Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
I'm Contessa Brewer in for Brian Sullivan tonight. Right now on Last Call, NVIDIA's huge moment, a make or break conference, could determine the next phase of the AI boom. We have a special preview. Oh, not again. Another incident just reported involving a Boeing jet. We'll give you the details. An earthquake for housing. How a historic settlement stands to change what buyers pay for a home. The EV rush now costs one CEO his job. We have breaking developments. Upping the ante, March Madness prepares to tip off, and women may be gambling on it like never before. Plus, this is booze you can use. St. Patrick's Day is upon us. We'll show you where people are planning to party and spend the hardest. It's not where you think. All that and more over the next hour. Last Call is up right now. Here we are Friday evening on the East Coast. Good afternoon to you out west. We kick off Last Call with the market rally hitting the brakes. The major indices finished the week on a low. The S&P 500 notched its second losing week in a row. I mean, who even knew that was still allowed? It hasn't happened in more than 4 months. Adobe earnings weighed big on tech stocks today. Shares of the software company posted its worst day in a year and a half. Rising interest rates, also an increasing concern on Wall Street. The 10-year Treasury yield hovered above 4.3%, its highest level in more than 2 weeks. All of this ahead of next week's Fed decision. Investors will hang on Chair Powell's every word. So a key question weighing on investors' minds tonight, are stocks just taking a breather after weeks of gains, or is this an inflection point for the market? Let's talk about it with our leadoff market panel. Joining us now, Carson Group Chief Market Strategist Ryan Dietrich and Chief Investment Officer at G Squared Private Wealth and a CNBC contributor, Victoria Green. Ryan, let's begin with you. What do you think at this point? How much is Chair Powell's words and what the Fed says about the economy going to dictate what we see with treasuries and again with the markets next week?
Yeah, happy Friday and have a great St. Patrick's Day weekend, everybody out there. Thanks for listening. So listen, let's put this in context. Let's answer that in 1 second. So the last 20 weeks, S&P's up 16 of them. We just barely missed being up this week, which would have been 17 out of 20, which would have been the first time since 1964. Over those 20 weeks, we've gained 24%. That's like a really good year. So we've been optimistic. We've been bullish. We think maybe it is time for a little pause. And just remember this. From the middle of March until early April, in an election year, usually things don't do that well. So then here we are. We've got, obviously, the Fed coming up next week. We know the Fed's probably not going to say anything different than what they've been saying, we don't think. I mean, the truth, again, last comment here, the truth is what's happened the last 6 weeks. Well, stocks have rallied. Interest rate expectation cuts for interest rate cut expectations have lowered, yet earnings are up 2%. Forward estimates have actually gone up 2% more the past 6 weeks. I mean, the truth is this economy is strong. Maybe a couple less cuts if you have a strong economy. We don't think it's such a bad thing.
All right, Victoria, what do you think? Is this just a breather, as Ryan says, or could this be the start of a bear market?
Oh, absolutely not. I think it's a breather. And again, context is so important because it's 2 weeks down, but we're only less than negative 2% off of our highs. Both of the weeks were barely down. We rallied off our lows today. I think there's a lot of good things out there. I am watching some data. The worst thing for me was the retail spending. This rally has been on the consumer spending. And so we need to see if the weakness we saw in retail spending kind of goes forward into next month or if it was just a little bit of an anomaly. So what we see on earnings, what we see on income, what we see on consumer spending, to me, those will be huge clues as well as what the Fed does. But I think it's fairly baked in. We'll see if there's any changes in the dot plot, but it's very likely it's still going to be three cuts on the dot plot. And there was actually a lot of good today. The Treasury, yields bumping up, but 4-3 held, and that's been a resistance on the Treasury market. So yes, yields have risen, but they really didn't go above that resistance level. So we still have a lot of catalysts. Breather, yes. End of the bull market, not at all. I think there's still legs here to run.
We've seen new all-time highs this week for the likes of IBM, JP Morgan Chase, Caterpillar. Ryan, what do you make of the fact that where we have seen a rally, it's been broadening out?
No, that's a real positive thing. And you know, those names you just mentioned, like industrials. Look, since really you think about it, when all the talk about the Fed maybe not cutting as much was like January 31st. That was a couple Fed meetings ago. But since that day, materials have led. Industrials, financials have done very, very well. The cyclicals, one of our themes coming into this year was tech and communications did great. We think that baton gets passed around to some other areas. And to see the cyclicals leading, that's a really good thing. And we still like small and mid caps. I know everyone's large cap, small cap, but mid caps are probably our largest overweight bet here. And mid caps quietly are still doing really well and actually leading since January 31st. So I think that's a positive sign. And this broadening out is a healthy thing. We're going to have a pullback eventually. Markets are, it doesn't go up every day. Down 2 weeks in a row, barely, but still, when that happens, it'll be probably, if it's still broad based, we think it's still strong.
The estimate is that there are trillions of dollars sitting in cash funds. So, Victoria, if this is a breather and a pullback and an opportunity to get in, which stocks do you think right now, or which areas do you think are ripe for investment?
Well, I like value. I still wouldn't give up on the mega cap tech. I see AI as a transitional investment still. So if you have a chance to hop in some of those names, but
would you hop into Adobe right now?
Okay, so Adobe's a tough one for me because we do own Adobe and they broke my heart a little bit. And I was also disappointed in their conference call and they need Firefly to work. So I'm a little bit of a hold right now on Adobe. I'm interested in what they're doing, but I need to protect their moat. OpenAI is coming for them. New technology is coming. I still think their technology is superior, but Adobe did disappoint me. And so we are reevaluating what we're going to do there. Usually I'm a big buyer of the dip, but I need them. I was disappointed most on the comments. I need Firefly to come out. I need text to video. I need text to image for them to really integrate that and monetize it. And again, protect their moat because they've been so wonderful in content creation and content editing. And I think they failed to really tell their story to investors. And for me, that was a little difficult to hear. So Adobe for me as a hold. I think some other great mega cap tech that's fantastic. I like the energy space right now. IEA just switched from being in a potential crude oversupplied market to potential deficit. And like we said, some of those cyclicals are running. Not great for inflation if we see commodity prices come up here, but you can also kind of play that. And typically you get paid to sit in those areas. You're getting big fat dividends and energy for sure.
Victoria, Ryan, thank you for joining us in, kicking us off on the last night of the week. On to our studs and duds for the week. The biggest winners here, Miner, Freeport, McMoRan, up 12% on surging copper prices. Oracle, look at this, surging almost 12%, just crushing earnings expectations. 3M jumped 11.3% on naming a new CEO. But the biggest losers here, electronics components maker Jabil lost 18.4% after cutting its full-year forecast. Southwest Airlines, 17.5% lost over Boeing plane delivery fears. And Enphase Energy, 17.3% down this week. That's off sharply. Coming up, it may be the AI boom's biggest moment of the year. We have a special preview of NVIDIA's high-stakes developers conference. Plus, the EV pullback short-circuits the job of one CEO. Breaking developments ahead.
Canva presents stories to keep you up at night. It was an ordinary work day until...
The Singapore presentation is at...
3 a.m.
The office was shocked.
That's when we sleep.
Maya made it less scary with Canva.
I'll just record my presentation so Singapore can watch it anytime.
Record and present anytime with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Welcome back. A quick programming note here. Monday and Tuesday, Brian will be live from CERAWeek, the world's premier energy conference. And we have some great guests lined up for you throughout the day and live here on Last Call. ExxonMobil CEO, Shell CEO, ConocoPhillips CEO, Chevron's NextEra Energy, and many, many more. You do not want to miss this. All right, let's get to tomorrow's news tonight. The stories you and Wall Street will be talking about throughout the weekend. First up, a massive leadership change at Hertz. CEO and board member Stephen Scherr is out at the end of this month. And Gil West, former COO of Delta Airlines and GM's Cruise, is taking over effective April 1st. This follows a bad bet on EVs. It led to Hertz selling a third of its EV fleet because of high repair costs. Investors not very excited about the change. Shares down modestly in extended trading, down about 2%. Next up, you've got the FTC launching an inquiry into Reddit's AI deals ahead of its IPO. Specifically, and I'm quoting here, sale, licensing, or sharing of user-generated content with third parties to train AI models. It comes 1 month after Reddit and Google struck a multi-million dollar deal for AI training data. And finally, the AI craze has a chance to reach a fevered pitch at NVIDIA's developer conference next week. We're going to have the latest updates from the chip-making behemoth then. Investors and developers alike are eagerly awaiting that conference, dubbed the Woodstock of AI. It's the company's first in-person developer conference since the pandemic, and attendance is expected to exceed 16,000 people. On the agenda, the latest products and partnerships, plus a much-anticipated keynote from CEO Jensen Huang. Christina Partsenevelis is here with a preview of that event and more on the state of the AI chip race. Hi, Christina.
Contessa, the titles for this, it's not only the Woodstock of AI, the AI Palooza, the godfather of AI is going to take the stage. Every hotel in the city in San Jose is sold out for miles. I promise you, I can attest for that. Why? Well, NVIDIA shares have climbed, what, 80% just in the last 3 months alone, and the stock has moved over 2% just in the 8 out of 10 last trading sessions, even with no news catalyst. So one has to wonder how much is already priced into the stock. And what more can CEO Jensen Huang say to excite investors in his two-hour keynote on stage on Monday? Well, there's three key factors to look out for. First, the product roadmap for their new Blackwell AI chip, the B100. So you want to know how good the memory is. Will it outperform AMD? When will it actually be launched? Is it really going to be 30% higher in price point than compared to the previous H100 chip, which would mean maybe $40,000 for this kind of chip, and maybe some other specs for other chips as well? That's what we're looking for. Secondly, how is AI adoption growing at the enterprise level? It's been slow right now, with most of the demand focused around hyperscalers like Meta, you know, the deep pockets of Amazon, Google, etc. But NVIDIA's CEO has pointed out to enterprise demand being at the very early innings. So we expect Jensen Huang to hype up demand from other sectors like finance, healthcare, and the list continues. And we'll possibly get a few more partnership announcements as well. Lastly, inferencing, which helps spit out answers to questions on trained large language models. That is expected to drive future demand, especially since it already accounts for 40% of NVIDIA's data center revenue. And I know many may feel like they missed out on the NVIDIA stock boat, but other names are expected to move as well next week. Micron, which has earnings out on Wednesday, is expected to be a memory chip provider for NVIDIA's latest chip, so we could see a bump in that stock. We may get some more details about NVIDIA's AI chip, and that could be seen as a negative for AMD if the specs are better. So expect some volatility for AMD shares. Other firms like Broadcom, Oracle have alluded to partnerships with NVIDIA. And then lastly, Taiwan Semiconductor, the manufacturer of most NVIDIA chips. We probably will hear more about that relationship as well. But investors have to be or believe that not all of this upside is already priced into this stock, which has just soared, what, 80% in the last 3 months, let alone, like, what is it, 150% last year?
Mm. You know, 2 hours does not sound like a keynote to me. That sounds like a sermon. And I'm the daughter of a Baptist preacher. I can attest to that. Christina.
The gossipful of AI. That's what
right.
I also heard from an analyst. The gossipful of AI. So
thank you. Joining me now with more, Sarah Kuntz, the managing director at Clio Capital. You just heard Christina lay out all of the things that NVIDIA is expected to tell its crowd of people with their butts stuck in the chairs for 2 hours. I'm just curious, is most of the upside already baked into this stock? It has come so far and so fast.
You have to remember that the last time there was an in-person version of this conference, NVIDIA was worth about 2,000% less than it is now. It has been a massive, massive ramp up. They're a great company. Are they going to do that again in the next 5 years? That would be a miracle, my friend. So it is not likely. That being said, a lot of people really like this name. We're seeing more retail investors get into it. It's still a huge part of a lot of the indexes, and I don't think that's going to change overnight.
Sarah, you heard also Christina mentioning some of the other stocks that could see some movement next week: Broadcom, AMD, Oracle, Taiwan Semi. Do any of those speak to you when you're looking at the overall chip space and what AI could do for them?
Absolutely. I really like Taiwan Semiconductor. I've liked it for a while. I like AMD. I think, you know, even the ARMs of the world, although they're approaching the end of their lockup period, which is probably going to drive a bit of a dip. The reality is these are good companies. And I also like just some of the more sort of traditional tech names that have been in the AI space for a very long time. So like the Microsofts, which certainly have seen a benefit from OpenAI, but even Google, you know, these companies have a lot of AI engineers and they have been busy working on these things for just as long as Jensen.
Sarah, it's great to see you. Have a great weekend. Thank you. We have a quick programming note here. Jim Cramer will be on the floor of NVIDIA's conference, where he'll sit down with founder and CEO Jensen Huang in Squawk on the Street. That's 10:15 a.m. Eastern Time Tuesday. And then an exclusive two-part interview with Jensen Tuesday and Wednesday on Mad Money. You want to tune in for those big interviews next week. Still ahead, what you pay to buy a home will probably never, ever be the same. A historic settlement rocks the world of real estate. We'll show you what it means for your money next.
Welcome to the Canva guided meditation for stress at work. Impending deadline? Generate Canva presentations in seconds.
So fast.
Brainstorm got too big? Ooh. Summarize with AI in a click. Writer's block. Release with Canva Magic Write.
Magical.
Stress less and save time at canva.com. Designed for work.
Canva.
Well, it's Friday, so time for our weekly insider buying segment. And these are the biggest insider share purchases of the week, brought to us by our friends at Verity Data. Let's get started. Number five, Alphatech Holdings, a $256,000 buy from a longtime board member. Number four, Elanco Animal Health, a $322,000 buy from chairman. A couple other board members also bought in. Number three, Roku, a $500,000 first-time buy from board member Jeffrey Blackburn after the stock took an earnings and guidance hit. Lionsgate Entertainment CEO John Feltheimer making his first buy since 2005 for $884,000. Lionsgate recently announced plans to spin off its studio business and merge it with a SPAC. And for our top insider buy this week, and this is a big one, EchoStar board member James DeFranco buying up $2.67 million worth of shares. DeFranco co-founded Dish Network, which was acquired by EchoStar at the end of last year. So there you have it. Alphatech, Elanco Animal Health, Roku, Lionsgate Entertainment, and EchoStar. Thanks again to Verity Data. And a reminder, you can find more of this exclusive content at cnbc.com/pro or right here on Last Call. This weekend, Selection Sunday kicks off the NCAA's tourney for the nation's sportsbooks. March Madness represents a bigger money-making opportunity than even the Super Bowl because of the number of games and the length of March Madness. And you know what's really madness? Men are far more likely to bet on the games than women. I mean, women love sports. They love watching. They love playing. So why aren't they betting on sports?
When Caitlin Clark takes to the court for the NCAA women's tourney, she's expected to drive viewership and engagement higher. As women's sports grow more popular, so does the betting on women's sports. DraftKings showed us how the amount wagered or handle has grown over the last few years, though that doesn't necessarily mean more women are doing the betting. Even though women gamble in casinos and online, when it comes to wagering on sports, American men far outnumber the women by 95%, according to a 2023 Eilers & Krejcik research report. The American Gaming Association says the number of women have grown. It estimates 26% of U.S. sports bettors are women. Whatever the number, Val Martinez says she felt lonely when she started gambling on sports.
It was all very, you know, intimidating. That's why I decided to just film the content myself and create a platform that allows women to enter the industry without the friction.
I feel like I've thought about it before, just because, like, when people are, like, doing fantasy football or something, yeah. I'm like, I kind of want to try that, but I have no idea.
Her platform, Betting Ladies, educates would-be wagerers on the jargon and the strategy of sports betting.
Odds with a negative number indicate the favorite, and odds with a positive number refer to the underdog.
It also makes money when customers click through its site to open a sports betting account. It's clear the sportsbooks see the opportunity for growth. Penn Entertainment spent billions ditching the Barstool brand with its bad boy locker room humor and relaunching as ESPN Bet. In fewer than 2 months, Penn boasted 35% more women in its digital database than the same time the previous year. BetMGM says it saw a 25% increase in female sports bettors last year, and this year, 51% increase in the number of female bettors wagering on Super Bowl. FanDuel says it's seeing 40% of the activations from women this year, driven by what else? Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce. But if a Super Bowl romance can get women to try sports betting, it's the job of the apps and the sports books to show them the lasting entertainment value.
We've got to do a better job of making it relatable and consumable. So there's some great changes that we've made to the product to make it just easier.
We asked all of those sports books how big their female customer base really is. They wouldn't tell me. They said for competitive reasons. Only one did. It's called Better. It's an app that offers real money fantasy in 23 states and also has sports books in Ohio and Virginia. Its founder and CEO, Joey Levy, joins me now. So, Joey, you already told me, but tell the audience, how does your customer demographics break up in terms of men versus women?
Sure. Yeah, very excited to be here. Appreciate you having me. We estimate about 15 to 20% of our total customers today are female bettors, and that's only within our fantasy sports product and our sportsbook product. We're launching iGaming later this year, where we expect a larger proportion of female customers.
We see that more broadly, that iGaming means that women are participating nearly equal with men. In this case, why do you think, I mean, are you happy with that number? Do you think that that's a positive result, 15 to 20% women?
I'd be willing to bet that we're probably better than our competitors on this front. But with that said, I think there's a tremendous amount of room for improvement. And I was watching Val Martinez sort of provide some of her commentary right before coming on here. And I think what she said really hit the nail on the head here, which is that the product experiences are just generally uninterpretable. They're built for a historically male hardcore sports gambler. You have minus 175 money lines, plus 5.5 point spreads delivered in this spreadsheet-like UI.
That's Does not Better really, do that?
No. So Better is, you know, I would say, I think we're the only company that's really gone out of our way to simplify the product experience, make it intuitive for a really mass market consumer of casual sports fans, whether they're male or female. That accessibility of the product experience will really enable us to expand the total addressable market.
What's a better opportunity for Better? Your co-founder, Jake Paul, taking on Mike Tyson on Netflix. I mean, he's your brand spokesperson. He's the guy that is associated with Better. Or Caitlin Clark and the women's NCAA tourney taking over. Which might provide a better opportunity for you to get more women customers?
Sure. I mean, I think it's all the above. I would say, you know, obviously Caitlin Clark is more of an on-the-nose, you know, catering to female fans. But, you know, Jake is one of the most prominent internet celebrities, not just among men, but among women as well. And, you know, Jake has done a phenomenal job really elevating women's boxing, for example. I remember a couple years ago, I was at MSG, sold out crowd, Amanda Serrano, Katie Taylor, in what was the first time in over 100 years of MSG history where a women's boxing event headlined Madison Square Garden. And in the 8 years that I lived in New York, it was by far the most electric crowd I've seen.
We're showing here in the studio the makeup of your board members.
Sure.
All of them are men. How important is it to you to have more women with decision-making ability for your company that is still private and growing?
We're an early-stage business. There's room for improvement on that front. I'll say two things, though. One is that our senior leadership team has several female leaders on it, so decisions are being made by women at the company. And then, two, we've had regulators publicly commend us for having one of the most diverse gender and racial, with respect to gender and racial diversity, team compositions in the regulated market.
Joey, I just wanted to say you're also throwing down the gauntlet with limiting deposits for young bettors up to age 25. And banning credit cards to fund deposits. So you've made some big moves on that front. Thank you for joining us here at CNBC.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, a historic settlement turns the entire real estate industry on its head. What it means for the cost of your next home after this. Welcome back. An update to a story we've been covering on Last Call. There's been a major shakeup in the real estate industry because the National Association of Realtors has reached a more than $400 million settlement that could upend the real estate commission structure. Recall that the NAR had been found guilty in October of working to inflate commission fees. Right now, under the current system, real estate agents and brokers for both the home buyer and seller receive a split commission based off an advertised percentage of the price of the home. Typically, the number is about 5 or 6%. In other words, the seller's broker pays the buyer's broker for bringing in the customer. But under the new rules, that commission will be negotiated and likely would be lower. That could lead to savings in the form of reduced commissions, but it also could lead some buyers to abandon using agents altogether, which would leave, of course, some inexperienced home buyers in a lurch, or it could leave agents without a lot of business. Here's the thing. There's more than 1.5 million realtors in the U.S. and more than 100,000 brokerages, and this settlement could greatly upend how agents make money as well as how many agents indeed there are. Investors not really thrilled with the news. Companies like Zillow and Redfin all closing today sharply lower. The ruling, if approved by a federal judge, could go into effect by the summer. What does it mean for home prices and how much you'll pay if you sell your home or if you buy a home? Joining me now, lead attorney for the state of Missouri, who originally took on the National Association of Realtors, Michael Ketchmark, and Compass real estate broker and million-dollar listing Los Angeles Star, Josh Flagg. Michael, let me begin with you. Are you satisfied with this result? Is this, given all the effort and energy that you put into the case in Missouri, an outcome that you appreciate?
Yeah, I think it's awesome. What happened is we had a jury that came back with a $1.8 billion verdict. And now the National Association of Realtors, they've listened to what the jury said. The jury found that there's been conspiracy and there's collusion amongst NAR and these large real estate companies. And they said, we need to put a stop to it. We need to return the housing market to the free market and let homeowners who own their home make their own decision. And let's not force them to pay the buyer's commissions. And that's exactly what's happening here. It's a fundamental change in the way that the housing market's going to work. I call it hitting the reset button. And technology is now going to have a chance to work on behalf of homeowners instead of against them.
I just out of curiosity, Michael, do you own your home?
Yes, absolutely own my house.
Use a buyer's broker when you bought your house?
Sure. When we bought our house 20 years ago, we had no idea about things like the iPhone had didn't exist. We didn't have access to it. We actually met with the real estate agent at a local Perkins and had a cup of coffee and went through a phone book like a material called the MLS. And we looked at it that way. And we went around through open houses. Now you go online, you do it. Now you use technology. I used to rent VCRs and watch movies on Friday night from Blockbuster. Don't do that anymore. So technology does have a way of changing
things. Could you see yourself using an agent again to buy another house?
Sure, I think agents are great, and I absolutely would use an agent. I'd use an agent to help sell my house. I'd use an agent to help buy my house. But what I wouldn't do is force the homeowners to pay for it. I wouldn't make the homeowners be the ones, if they want to list a house, to go find an agent. You don't make them pay for the other side. It's just, there's no other industry in our country where that exists. And in the United States used to be the only place that that happened. It doesn't happen that way anymore, because now NAR is coming forward and changes are coming. And I know it's scary to people, and it's scary to people who are used to the way that it was. But look, it changes. We used to have travel agents where you'd want to book a plane flight or a hotel. You'd pay 10% to a travel agent. We don't use those anymore, do we? But people still travel. People are still going to buy houses. They're just going to be more affordable and less commissions. And that's a wonderful thing for our country.
Josh, what's your prediction about what happens to the system as a whole if the judge approves the settlement?
Well, I think I should just retire. I mean, I don't even know why I'm doing this anymore. You know, I don't know about you, but, you know, when I go to a restaurant, right, I pay for the service, I pay for the food, I pay for the experience. I don't eat home every night. Do you expect to go to the restaurant and just not pay the bill and leave? Does that make sense, what I'm saying? So what are real estate agents? Why are we in business? Why are we here? If we're not needed and we shouldn't get paid, why don't homeowners put their house on the market for sale and just let the buyer go direct and see how that turns out when you negotiate the deal?
Great question, Josh. I'll answer it. When you go to a restaurant, you're expected to pay your own bill. When I go to the restaurant, I sit down at my house, I pay my own person. You're at the restaurant, you don't look over the person sitting next to you and say, hey, pay my bill. While you're here, why don't you pick up my tab? In our country, if you own something, you ought to be able to sell it without having to pay the other person. Why don't you retire?
Right.
So you're a very capable person. I went on your website and saw it. You're involved in listing some houses for $11, $12 million. You don't need to pay a buyer's agent $300,000 to show that
house.
Why
not?
But the person, why not? Because it's a gross overpayment. It's one of the reasons that commissions are out of control in our country. It's one of the reasons.
But why? Tell me why $300,000 is a great. Tell me why
$300,000 a year in commissions.
Why is $300,000 a gross overpayment? Don't you know what the broker? It's not. Hey, I just showed up at the house and I'm just showing it. You think that's all that they do?
No, absolutely not. But if you're able to represent somebody who's buying an $11 million house, have that person pay you. Justify what it's worth. Use the free market. Don't make the homeowner. Don't capture the homeowner.
It's
an old system, Josh. It doesn't exist anywhere in the world.
What about when the buyer is going to buy a house? He's not paying a commission. It's a wash.
Why are you online here, or why are you on this show defending a system that the entire industry has gone away from? Keller Williams
is abandoned. Because it's worked forever, and there's no reason to interrupt it. It's worked.
I have a question, Josh.
NAR's now abandoned it, but you're working for a company that refuses to abandon it. You cannot continue to rip off money from homeowners because you don't want to retire.
I actually take offense to that. I take offense to that.
Rip off home sellers is what I said. You're charging people who
the sellers are more than happy to pay it because
they know what they're getting because you don't want to retire.
Do you know why the seller hires me? Because they know they couldn't do it on themselves. They could never do it on their own.
I'm not talking about you representing the seller. Represent a seller all you want. I'm talking about when you're representing the seller, don't make that man or woman pay the buyer's agent. Have that buyer negotiate.
They want to pay it. They're happy. They call me and they say, please, we would love to pay you because you're an expert and you know what you're doing.
Josh, I'm just curious. Now, my understanding is that this means that buyers can go negotiate with a broker independently from what the sellers have negotiated with their agent. In essence, you have a more of a separation so that the buyer's broker is not trying to has an incentive for the home price to be higher so that they're making a percentage commission off that higher price. Is there anything wrong with the buyer's negotiating separately from the sellers about their representatives?
Yeah, so here's what's going to happen. When I go on a listing appointment, sometimes the sellers of the property will say to me, hey, Josh, okay, the commission's 5%. Can you give me a break? And I'll say, okay, well, here's what could happen. You could hire me at XYZ commission, or you could go and find somebody in, you know, Timbuktu who will probably sell this to you for 1%, a lot less than I'll charge them. But guess what? You're going to get their service, right? There's a lot of people that will happily take discount commissions, but you're going to get that quality of service, right? But by the way, sellers are not obligated to pay a set fee. Like, I know the 5% and 6% number keeps getting thrown out. There's no law that they have to do that. But smart sellers that are out there want to pay.
Josh, here's a newsflash. Today, The National Association of Realtors reached a settlement that they're stripping commissions off
the MLS. Aware.
You are not going to be able to go onto the MLS now and bribe the other side by hiring commissions and splitting it. Half the time these corporations have been making their money representing sellers, half the time they're making them representing buyers. And they engage in this collusion to artificially inflate the prices of commissions. That's what the jury found. That's what's been happening. It's changing. And a change is in the air. And you can either defend a system that everyone's leaving behind and be a relic of the past and talk about how it used to be so great when there's a Blockbuster on every corner, or you can realize that technology is here to change. You're a very talented person. I urge you and other agents like you to join with these companies that are changing it. Compass needs to join with these companies. Compass is one of the
let me just ask you, what are you What are you urging me to do?
I'm urging you to recognize that the MLS is no longer going to be a vehicle for doing this. And if you want to represent buyers, justify yourself to the clients who are hiring you, the buyers, and have them pay you. Don't force sellers to pay you to show the property. Don't force
I don't get it. My sellers are happy to pay the commission because they know when they go to buy the next house, they're not paying a commission. It's a wash.
This doesn't involve them. This is about forcing sellers to pay the buyer's commission. Don't do it. You can't.
They're happy to do it. That's what I'm trying to tell you.
One more point here.
Force a seller to pay a buyer's commission.
It is still possible that the buyers could go and say to a seller, listen, I'll buy your house, but I want you, the seller, to pay for my agent. I want you to pay for my representative. My only question about that is, how do you do that preemptively? Like, you hire the broker first and then trust that the seller is going to go along with it?
You can. It's going to be a disaster. There's a set way, and the system has worked all this time. Why would you change it?
It's worked 100 years to rig the prices the way it's worked. That's one of the reasons that the commissions in this country
are twice as high as the rest of the world. You must be a very wealthy man. Let me ask you this.
It's worked to put money in the pockets of these millionaire real estate agents who are on these shows talking about their $300,000 commissions for showing a house. That's who it's worked for. It's worked for
these corporations. Let me ask you a stupid question.
Okay, I'm not homeowners. It hasn't
let me ask you a stupid question. Let me ask you a stupid question. I might not be the brightest guy here. Okay. You're selling your house. Out of the proceeds come the commissions. You're a buyer and you want to buy a house. And let's just say it's a $10 million house. Okay. Because I know what you're going to say. Let's say it's $1 million house. Okay. Where are you going to come up with the proceeds to pay the commission? Because generally, you've saved up all your money so that you could put a down payment on a house. Now you need to come up with these extra.
You don't know what I'm going to say. If you're affording an $11 million
home. No, I thought you were going to say we're not talking about $10 million houses because this is middle America.
If you're affording an $11 million home, pay for your own buyer's commission. Don't take it out of the person that's selling. Oftentimes, $11 million homes are being sold by estates and people who have passed away. You're ripping them off.
Well, guess what's going to happen? The system's going to then come down.
That's the reason everybody has abandoned.
A lot of people don't have.
I'm going to have to leave it here. It's clear this could be an hour-long conversation and maybe over beer next time. Thank you so much.
Yeah, that's fine. Have your company join in with the settlement because they're one of the holdouts, and it's not right.
That's not going
to
happen.
Compass needs to get on board with this because it's the right thing to do.
Michael, thank you for that. Appreciate it. Josh, I appreciate your presence. Thank you. Coming up, it's not Boeing's week. Another incident happening with one of its jets just a short time ago. Fast-moving developments next.
Being a change maker reflects our sense of urgency across the country as we set about to improve the lives of cancer patients and their families. This year in the United States, there'll be more than 2 million people who hear for the first time that they have a cancer diagnosis, and more than 600,000 individuals who will lose their life from cancer. I'm so interested in not just medicine, but also the business of medicine and how we can accelerate progress through cancer by adopting a business mindset toward doing good in the world.
Welcome back. It's time for a bonus. Tomorrow's News Tonight, a messy week for Boeing, taking another rough turn. A short time ago, a United Boeing 737-800 flight from San Francisco was found to be missing an external panel. The discovery came after the jet landed as scheduled in Medford, Oregon. United tells the local NBC affiliate it will, quote, conduct an investigation to better understand how the damage occurred. No issues were reported during the flight. Everyone is safe. But it doesn't stop there for Boeing tonight. Also just developing, Bloomberg reports a federal criminal probe into the company is expanding. A grand jury has been convened to investigate suspected violations of federal criminal laws tied to January's door plug blowout of an Alaska Air 737 MAX 9 jet. The subpoena reportedly seeks documents and communications related to Boeing and to one of its big suppliers, Spirit AeroSystems. These are just the latest in a seemingly never-ending series of bad headlines involving safety-related incidents with Boeing planes. Those events, combined with the apparent suicide of a Boeing whistleblower, have put the tin hat crowd in a veritable frenzy. So how should Boeing better handle these incidents and the media firestorm around them? Let's bring in Wharton School of Business professor, CNBC contributor Americus Reed, and Desenhall Resources CEO Eric Desenhall. Desenhall is a leading high-stakes communications consulting firm. Thank you both for joining us tonight on Last Call. First of all, about the whistleblower's death. This one is very concerning, and I'm just wondering, Eric, what you make of Boeing and how it should respond in this case as even more criminal investigations seem to be expanding.
Well, in my end of the business, you have to look at it like emergency room triage. What do we address first? Because you can't address everything. And the first things first are safety issues. If there is an engineering problem, you have to fix the engineering problem and tell various audiences, the government, airlines, consumers, why they should feel safe. A few months ago, when all of this started, with issues with the panels, the planes were grounded. When you tell the people that those particular planes were grounded, they feel safer about getting on them to some degree. Now you have a cascade of issues, each of which has to be addressed technologically before you can address what is a long-term issue, which are the management and cultural issues, which are going to take a long time to knock off.
Americus, Congress has already laid down the gauntlet for Boeing and said what it expects in this case. And regulators have said what that they expected from Boeing after the MAX jet came under so much scrutiny and problems during the pandemic. Give me a sense of what you think each drop, the new headlines. Now today, an external panel being off of a plane when it lands in Medford, Oregon. What does this do for the business of Boeing?
Well, it's a great point. First, it's great to be with you, Contessa. I think I want to build on Eric's point here, because I think what you see is, and you can just look at the stock price over the last several months, what you see here is something that's really spiraling out of control. And I think what people don't understand is that in brand crisis communications, you know, why do crises take off and explode and get spread? And it's really because they are compelling stories. So if you're in one of these situations, you're a company, brand, service, organization, there's really, what is a great story? A great story has a victim. A great story has a hero. A great story has a villain. And one of the things you're really trying to do is make sure that you don't get pegged the villain too quickly, because the story is unfolding. I think it's a little bit too late. I mean, we've got a 2022 documentary called Downfall of Boeing that's running on Netflix. We've got all of these stories that are popping up. We've got all of this sort of discussion and fear. And by the way, people should be concerned, because when you look at it, there's only really two places you can buy commercial airplanes in this country. That's Airbus and Boeing. So it's not like you can jump around and say, you know what, I'm not going to fly Boeing airplanes anymore because I'm afraid of this. So there's a big problem here. I think it's very late in the game. I think there has not been enough validation of the concerns, an action plan, and a controlling of the narrative in this case.
Quick answer here. Is it insurmountable? What do you think, Eric?
Oh, no, it's not insurmountable. Every time one of these things happens, everybody says, can the company survive? Most of these big companies do survive. The problem is, it's very, very difficult to survive the short-term news cycle, where everybody expects if you fire the CEO, the problem goes away in 30 seconds. And that's just simply not realistic.
Eric Desenhall, it's great to see you. Americus Reed, great to see you too and have you here. Thank you very much, gentlemen. We have more Last Call next. Welcome back to Last Call. It's now time for everyone's favorite Friday segment. It's Booze You Can Use. You see me today, I'm wearing green. You're likely to see a lot more people this weekend wearing and spending green if you venture out, because St. Patrick's Day, and more Americans typically celebrate St. Patrick's Day when it falls on the weekend because, hello, duh. How much celebrating do Americans really get up to, and how much green will they spend this year? Here with the numbers, CNBC's Brandon Gomez, who brought along some delicious treats.
I did. Spoiler alert, people are going to spend on booze this weekend, right? But you got to zoom out and see just how much people are spending, right? I mean, you're dressed in green. You look like you're ready to go out there.
Thank you.
You will not be alone. 162 million Americans expected to be out on St. Patrick's Day this weekend, spending $7.2 billion. That's on everything from green shamrock beads to green cardigans, but also booze, right? Guinness. You have the Jameson here. People are going to be spending on booze just as much as they are on their apparel.
Okay. Is Guinness the number one brand that people buy on St. Patrick's Day, or are there others?
So, I mean, Guinness, obviously, we're talking about Harp, right, Bo? There's also some ciders that folks also indulge in. The thing that you have to think about, too, is that just because it's St. Patrick's Day isn't going to make somebody who doesn't already naturally like the flavor of Guinness enjoy Guinness. So they might go for their specialty cocktail that they normally get, but the drinking is still going to be up.
Also, in my experience in Ireland, it's that you have to leave, you have to not eat if you're going to drink Guinness because it really does fill you up. Okay, in what cities do people celebrate and booze up the most over St. Patrick's Day?
So you can look at it one of two ways. There's a lot of surveys out there, but one thing that NerdWallet did was look and see which cities actually have the most Irish bars and pubs per capita. That list,
Boston.
You want to guess
them? I'm guessing Boston.
Boston's in there. Boston's in the top five.
Yeah, New York. Philadelphia.
Not Philadelphia.
Oh.
Chicago, Seattle, and in Florida
as
well.
Seattle has more than Philadelphia? That seems crazy to me. Okay.
Yeah. So, and then Tampa, Florida as well. But if you want to get a deal, there are some cities that have the lowest average price for beers. Now, that's all beers overall. You have Milwaukee, Madison, Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I got to give a shout out to Worcester. It's the alma mater hometown for myself, College of the Holy Cross. You know, some of those Irish Catholic students of legal drinking age might be picking their own pints up this weekend.
You know what they did? They put all this beer on the set, and they didn't even give us a bottle opener. And these are not the twist-off kind.
We can't even indulge.
I don't think, but I don't have my reading glasses. So, you know, I think it's exciting. It turns out that Nevada, they spend a lot of money on booze.
They do. Yeah. You know, and you would know maybe like the upcharge on the strip.
Yeah, there you go. That is your last call tonight. Brian returns Monday live from the CERAWeek Energy Conference in Houston with a huge lineup of guests. American Greed next.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you. Like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.